Good morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto, the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I call this meeting of the committee to order. Welcome to our members of the public who are joining us via live stream. This meeting is called pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings such as this. Meeting materials have been posted to our committee website, so I'd encourage folks to check that out. They've also been sent out via email to the members and staff and guests that are on the call. And so we're going to begin, as we always do, with a call of the roll. Ms. Chambers, if you can do that, please.
Yes. Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Clotiza Watun.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Waslowick.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Present.
Okay, we have a quorum.
Thank you. And next item is that we have a that we have the minutes from our February 2nd meeting, and I'll ask our Vice Chair, Representative Pryor, to move approval of those minutes, if you could.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. Any additions or corrections to those minutes? You see, not hearing anything. So all in favor of approval of the February 2nd minutes, please say aye.
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 And anybody saying nay? And with that, our February 2nd minutes are approved. And so we will move on with some presentations. And so members, we're returning to just lay a foundation of knowledge about the programs that the committee oversees, making sure that we review that. And today we're addressing the Child Care Assistance Program, Child Development Services Grants, I think I'm saying that correctly, and then Parent Aware, which I hope leads into a bit of a discussion about the broader issue of quality in early care and learning. And so I'm going to turn to our first presenter, who is Lori Pacine, to speak about the Child Care Assistance Program. And Ms. Pacine, if you can identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Good morning. Yes, I am Lori Pacine. I'm the manager of the Child Care Assistance Program at the Department of Human Services. And chair and members of the committee, Jennifer Sommerfeld is going to help with showing our slides, and I will go through them and tell you about the Child Care Assistance Program in Minnesota. Next slide. So the overview of child care assistance in Minnesota is that we help pay for child care while parents are working or going to school. We help ensure children are well cared for and prepared to enter school. About 30,000 children are served throughout the state. And just a little bit of the demographics, 69% of children served are children of color, American Indian children, and about 60% are five or younger, meaning that about 40% are school age. One question that sometimes people ask is, how is CCAP administered? The Child Care Assistance Program is, the local agencies do manage the administration of the program on a day-to-day basis. In other words, they work with families, they register the providers who serve families, and they pay the bills that providers submit for their services. So the local agencies basically determine eligibility and answer probably hundreds and thousands of questions on a daily basis around the state about how CCAP works and what families need to do to get on the program and stay on the program. And then they help providers navigate some of the administration pieces that providers have to do to continue to be paid by CCAP. So the Department of Human Services, oh, back one slide, thanks. So what we do is we oversee the program. So we develop policies, we bring legislative ideas, of course, to the governor. We respond to ideas that others have for policies. We make sure that our federal guidance is followed. And then we help local agencies with numerous ways of issuing guidance, technical assistance, training, and materials that help them to better serve families and providers. And of course, we are the oversight body to make sure that federal, state, and county laws are followed. Okay, next slide. Thank you. In last state fiscal year, the Child Care Assistance Program provided about almost $246 million statewide of funding for direct services to families. $140 million of it last year came from, or was directed towards, came from both federal and state funding, but was directed towards the MFIP, or Minnesota Family Investment Program, side of the Child Care Assistance Program. And about almost $106 million of the kind of same pots of monies, except for that counties do add a portion towards the basic sliding fee assistance program. Next slide. Just a little bit more about the sub-programs. For those that get used to acronyms, apologize for the acronyms, but the Minnesota Family Investment Program and Diversionary Work Program are often referred to as MFIP and DWP. And when families enter and need child care through that avenue, there is no waiting list because that's a forecasted program. The same is true for transition year. So transition year and transition year extension are mechanisms to pay for childcare for those families that have left MFIP or DWP. And it kind of keeps the bridge going until the basic sliding fee becomes available. So for families who do enter via the MFIP or DWP route, they would move on to transition year sometimes. Not always. Counties have long waiting lists and the TYE is needed, which is why it's called transition year extension. And that ensures that there's no break in services for families. Then ultimately, if a family stays on longer, they are moved to the basic sliding fee, or a family that never received cash assistance through MFIP or DWP would go into the basic sliding fee program, and this is where we often have a waiting list. Next slide. One caveat to the basic sliding fee, there's a portability pool, and that is managed statewide to make sure also that when a family moves from a county to county, there is no gap in services. Actually, thanks to a change in policy and investment a couple of years ago, we made sure that gap stayed closed so that families who move don't lose their services. So that is it's a mechanism within basic sliding fee, but just wanted to explain what it was.
Ms. Pacino, before you move on, I wonder if I was going to bring this up later, but it feels like maybe this is a good spot on these two slides, is if you can talk about the idea of just in general concept, we'll see a bill later, but about reprioritizing the waiting list, or sort of just the interaction between those three programs. Maybe, I don't know if you need to go back one slide to do that, but as long as you're talking about
Jennifer,
these,
yeah, if you could go back, Jennifer, that'd be great.
I'd like to call attention. Oh, Representative Pryor, pardon me.
And I have a clarifying question too on that slide also, if I may ask it now.
Yeah, please. Let's do Representative Pryor's question first, and then get to mine. Yeah, apologies for not seeing your hand, Representative Pryor, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Ms. Hossein, could you? I missed it. So why is there no waiting list for the MFIP or the DWP program? What's the mechanism, the different mechanisms to make sure that there's always enough money to make sure all those families are covered?
It's a terrific question, Representative Pryor. That's helpful. Representative Ms. Placine, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, yes, those are forecasted programs. So the language in law ensures that the state continually looks at the forecast and invests the amount needed to cover the costs.
Representative Pryor, follow up on that? Nope. And Ms. Posting, can you just for my own purposes too, for clarification. So basically, is it right then that the first two of these are programs where we've identified what causes a family to have a need, and then we just automatically meet the need? We say we're going to meet the need. The family has a need. We're going to meet it. That's what forecasting means. And it's the third one, the basic sliding fee, that instead we allocate a certain amount of money, and then just it goes to however many families we can, given that amount of money, but then that's why we have a waiting list, because the money doesn't always meet that need. Is that correct?
Chair Pinto, yes, that is correct.
Good, thank you. Yeah, and then given that, can you explain about the reprioritization?
The transition year and transition year extension, yes. So some advocates and others have and MACSA, the county organization, and others have brought forward the idea of reprioritization, which, as Representative Terrapinto mentioned, is in House File 5. And that mechanism would bypass families who are otherwise on transition year and kind of put them at the end of the line instead of at the beginning of the line.
And folks, I'm hoping members are understanding what you mean by that. Could you just clarify a little more about end of line versus beginning?
Yes. Yeah. Another way of saying it is that if you reprioritized families who right now in basic sliding are waiting on basic sliding fees, so they didn't come in through the MFIP TY channel. So they're just right now they're at the fifth priority or the last priority. And what you would do if they were reprioritized, because first when a county has money, they first go to the transition year families, or actually second, teen parents always get served first. So counties would normally turn to transition year as they're opening up their basic sliding fee money. And if you reprioritize, families who aren't getting services would get funds about 2 months sooner.
And Ms. Posine, one other question. It's not really said in the slides exactly, but is it kind of an income situation where the lowest income families would be receiving MFIP, and as a family's income increases, that's where they're transitioning over time to basic sliding fee? It may be a little more complicated than that. Can you just talk about that?
Chair Pinto, yes. By nature, yes, the families have, just by the mechanisms of that, when you are on MFIP, you have to be the lowest of income, have the lowest of incomes. But there, other than that, there's no stratification within the programs once you're in them. And we'll talk about income eligibility in a few slides, but so just as a group, MFIP and TY families have lower incomes. Basic sliding fee, there's an entrance level, which we'll talk about, but other than that, there's no stratification for income.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. And members, I hope you don't mind my pausing on this spot, but it seemed important for us to understand these programs and how they fit together. And Ms. Wilson, thanks so much. Please continue. I don't think there are other clarifying questions I'm seeing. Yeah, thanks so much.
Certainly. Yes. A good thing to know is roughly how much does the child care assistance program pay towards helping families with their child care costs. In fiscal year 20, an MFIP or TY family the reimbursement was about a little under $1,600 a month. And that was for just under 15,000 families and about 7,300 families. I'm sorry, 15,000 children and about 7,000 families last year. And this is where you might see the difference, because basic sliding fee, see below, the average payment was less, closer to $1,198 in fiscal year 20. And that's where you would see the difference, because families are earning more, therefore the co-payments are more. And we'll talk about co-payments in another slide as well. So you can see also that the monthly average for family children and families served is not too different for basic sliding fee and MFIP-TY. So really about almost 50-50 in the state getting services from each of those pots of money. In November of 2020, however, there were the 1,900 families on the waiting list for the basic sliding fee program. Okay, so back to who can get CCAP. The income, which I'll show another slide about this, but they have to have income under 47% of the state median income to get into the program. We'll show what that means, but counties would help review the family's income to make sure that they're under the limits when they enter the program. The family has to be in an authorized activity. Most families, about 92% of those that get CCAP, are in a work activity. Only 8% are in just education. And usually when they're in an education activity, it's not for very long. So maybe a year off most often. Again, most families, 92% of them are working or in a work school combination, which is also not uncommon. Families have to cooperate with child support. So there's a mechanism for child support enforcement to happen. And then if that does, that income counts in their family income that's included for their CCAP eligibility. The Child Care Assistance Program serves children through age 13 or 15 if the child has special needs. So that's why we have that 40% of families that are school-age children getting services through the Child Care Assistance Program. When they complete the application and then when they have to re-verify at least every 12 months, they do verify income, identity, key pieces of verification to be served on the Child Care Assistance Program, and that is the work that's done at the counties. Children do meet immigration and citizenship requirements. I'm sorry. Okay, next slide. As I mentioned, income eligibility, we do look at gross family income. However, we do deduct medical and dental expenses, or premiums. I'm sorry, not all expenses, but premiums. So we look at gross income, including child support. For the Child Care Assistance Program, the 47% is the state median income threshold, and they have to be below that to get into the basic sliding fee program. For MFIP, it is a little bit different because they are coming up through MFIP, and if by chance when a family on the Minnesota Family Investment Program or MFIP leaves MFIP, it is possible that they have income over the 47% of the state median income. But because they've been getting served, we don't view that as needing to meet another threshold. So we do have separate exit levels for the whole child care assistance program. So beginning last October, just as an example, the income for a family coming in on basic sliding fee, gross income needed to be below $42,920 a year. So that might be two parents and a child, or it might be one parent, two children. Again, when families leave the Child Care Assistance Program, they do leave when their income goes over 67% of the state median income. There was a federal clause added that we enacted a couple of years ago that if a family is in a 12-month eligibility period, their income can go as high as 85% of the state median income, but only during that 12 months. At a 12-month period, if they're over 67% of the state median income, they would lose their eligibility. But during a 12-month eligibility period, if it's 85%, if their income goes up, you know, significantly, then they would lose their eligibility during a 12-month period. And sometimes families leave the child care assistance program when their copay exceeds their cost of care. And that does happen when children get older and families' income goes up. And that is by design to help families exit out of the program more smoothly. And we do have a complete copay and family size chart that I just wanted to note is available. Next slide, please. Jennifer, next slide, if you're available.
I think we can see the next slide, the parent copayment slide is up for us.
Okay.
Are we able to see that? Yeah.
I just have to find it now.
Okay,
there we go. All families who earn at the 75% of the federal poverty level, so really most families pay copays based on family income. And examples of that are that a family of three that earns $45,660 a year, so 50% of the state median income, pays biweekly $105, so a little over $200 a month. And then a family who exits MFIP and then earns $28,968, so that's the exit level as you're coming off MFIP. If you're a family of three, so like maybe you've just gotten a job, your copay biweekly is $34.
Ms. Bosin, can I just ask, 75% of the federal poverty guidelines, so about how much of an income is that on that first bullet?
I do not have that in front of me.
Please continue. You can just send that to us, I just would be curious, or even if you have a sense, it may be that somebody else on the call even has a sense of what precisely the federal poverty guideline is, and we'll just figure it's three quarters of that.
It's in these charts. I do know that.
No problem. We can.
Yes.
And I suspect a little later in the presentation, I suspect somebody will have texted or sent it to somebody on the call. We can do it. So please continue.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Next slide. So to tell you more about where families choose to bring their children when they get CCAP, it's basically any legally operating child care program. And licensed centers serve child care assistance program children on a regular basis. Also, licensed family child care homes. On the next slide, I have some numbers for you. And certified exempt centers, those are programs that primarily serve school-age children. So they are often located in school districts or a YMCA, Boys and Girls Club, that nature. And then family, friend, and neighbors are a small slice of who serve the child care assistance program families, but they are allowed. And when they join and are registered for the CCAP program, they also have background studies, they do some training, and they take first aid and CPR, including in their training. Okay, next slide. In state fiscal year 2020, the provider types that were registered, to include licensed centers. So 1,180 centers serving CCAP families statewide, certified centers, 582, so together, almost 1,700 center-based kind of programs serve CCAP families. Licensed family child care, just over 2,000. And then legal non-licensed is the small slice I was talking about of families who are family, friends, and neighbor. And we do have a complete provider profile available as well, which shows some more slices of data about the providers that serve the Child Care Assistance Program families.
And members, this slide and the prior slide are a nice collection for those new to child care about the different kinds of provider types, not just those receiving CCAP, but if you think back to the boxes on the prior slide, that these are the different ways that the children receive at least legal care in terms of being able, some of them are non-licensed, but recognizing these different ways of how this can work. Can you share, Ms. Pacine, about what proportion of some of these groups are registered to receive CCAP versus are not registered to receive CCAP, if you just have a sense of that?
I know. We can verify, but I'm about 85% of the center base group are 85% of the what would be available statewide otherwise. I know that is pretty close to the exact number, around 85%. Licensed family child care, I think that's about a little over a fourth of the license. I think there's about 8,000 right now, if I remember correctly. So
that sounds about right to me. Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you so much. And please continue.
Back to the copay question. I can answer that now if you'd like.
Sure,
relative to the 75th percentile, or when a family has income at 75% of the federal poverty guideline. A family of three, that's about $16,290 a year.
And so to clarify, Ms. Pacine, when a family of three is making that much, $16,000, that's when we start requiring that family to make a copay for their child care.
Correct. And initially, most common, that's $5 every 2 weeks. So that's... Okay. That's the normal first copay on our copay scale.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Please continue.
Okay, next slide, please. So I wanted to really highlight the investments made in the last few years and how we achieved some federal compliance as well. I'm sorry. No, that's not this slide. I'm sorry. Difference. Recently, an investment was made and that came before this committee as well, that with some new federal money, we infused $15 million into the basic sliding fee waiting list. So if you recall on the other slide where I said there were 1,900 families on the waiting list in November, we have not yet checked with counties. The money was infused about 2 weeks ago. And so counties were notified and can begin accessing that money to serve families. And so we're expecting that 1,900 number to start coming down. Over the course of the 2 years where we're spreading the money out so that families that start to get served now in the next 6 months might continue into calendar year 22. So that could serve up to 780 new families. And it is estimated that 82% of the families on CCAP broadly are working in critical sectors. And again, counties just received those notices recently. Next slide, please. This is where I want to talk about the progress made towards federal compliance. Apologize, on this slide there's a typo. September 2020, we raised the legislature passed the higher rate, the 25th percentile, so rates were increased for the first time since 2004. And it was based on that at that time on the 2018 market rate survey data. And that achieved minimal federal compliance for 1 year.
Can I just pause you for a second? Because I don't think we talked very much about rates before this. Can you just talk at just lay the foundation for how rates are set for providers in the program? I mean, the fact that there is this survey every few years, can you just sort of make sure that folks understand that before we get to the federal compliance piece?
Certainly, yes. Chair Pinto and members, the child care assistance program, as is federally required, and it's in our state statute now as well, that we conduct a market rate survey of all providers in Minnesota every 3 years. And that's a pretty rigorous, statistically sound, highly vetted process that every provider is contacted multiple times if they don't reply. We ask them what all of their rates are charged to all families. And so we assess the rates. Once that they're all compiled, we look at hourly rates, daily rates, weekly rates by provider type. So center-based, home-based, and by age of child. So infant, toddler, preschool, and school age. So all of that data is assessed, and what the 25th percentile, for instance, is if you stack the lowest rate to the highest rate, the 25th percentile would be the bottom fourth of prices charged to families when we determine those maximum rates that are then linked into payments. So when a child care provider, if you think about this from a provider's point of view, they get a service authorization that says, for Joey Smith, you are going to be reimbursed, making up a number right now, $200 a week by the CCAP program. If you charge more than that, the family's responsible to pay. And then the family pays, it might pay their co-payment. But other than that, the provider gets this 25th percentile rate as their payment. So it really means that, again, we're only fully covering a quarter of the private pay market.
That's really helpful. Thank you very much. And then please continue then with the rest of the slide. Thank you.
Yes, and so just to repeat, we are that survey is underway right now per the federal requirement and state requirement that we do a survey every 3 years, and the federal government expects to see new rates tied to the latest survey. Okay, so some things that have happened recently that have benefited families, I just want to point out. We, in September of this year as well, but based on the previous year's legislative actions, started to expedite child care for families experiencing homelessness. So this does allow some children to start getting services sooner because the counties need to review their applications within 5 days. And if there are missing verifications, families have up to 3 months to get them in.
Ms. Pearson, we have a question from Representative Pryor, I suspect, before we flip the slides. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I realized, again, that there's something I need clarification on. So on that, the amount of payment that the provider gets, so I understand it's the 25th percentile. Is the family always responsible for some of the payment?
Ms. Pearson.
Representative Chair Pinto, yes. Well, the family who has a copay, so some don't, that very lowest MFIP small group who maybe don't have a job yet, usually might not, that might be the only slice that doesn't have a copay. But any family who has a copay pays that, plus the child provider is free to charge the family any difference in the rates.
Okay.
So that when it's not fully covered.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if you're not in that group of the MPIP, but you are receiving CCAP, then you have a co-payment. And then, so then it's what's expected of the family plus what the state is going to give equals that 25th percentile?
Ms. Posehn?
I think that's accurate. I have to think about it in another way. I mean, yes, because that's true. Because the rate, if the rate is $200 a week, they are reimbursed that, but the family copay is deducted. So yes, that is true.
All right, thank you.
Sorry, I have to do the mental math.
All right, Representative Pryor, looks like you're okay. Nothing further. Okay, we'll move to the next slide as you were.
Okay, next slide. We did want to mention, as this the governor's budget has been released, the department has drafted what we need to do to set the rates at a higher rate to tie to the most recent market rate survey, and the governor's proposal lifts that threshold to the 30th percentile. And the benefits of that are that it reduces families' out-of-pocket expenses, makes more providers willing to accept CCAP, helps providers improve the quality of their services, and, of course, supports the risk of losing federal funds.
Ms. Posehn, can you just clarify what is the federal standard that we should be meeting?
Chair Pinto, members, the federal standard has been the 25th. Last year, when we determined the 25th percentile was the lowest we could go, it was the 25th percentile. The feds have indicated they will be raising the threshold, but so far they have enforced the 25th percentile. The federal benchmark is the 75th percentile. It's a little unclear in this moment what the feds would say is required other than the 25th, but the 75th is the benchmark. So,
about the standard, or you called it the benchmark. I think there was a bit of confusion there. Can you just clarify what the 75th percentile is?
Yes. So the federal language talks about rate compliance as equal access, meaning providing equal access to the market so that families who get assistance with their child care aren't in a disadvantage to families who pay on their own. And so the language in the federal regulation speaks to the 75th percentile as a benchmark that would ensure equal access.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Thanks for the clarification. Thanks very much.
Okay, next slide. We did want to point out that the federal language and Minnesota's desire, if you will, is to provide higher access to high quality care. And because we have a 15% differential in our rates, so we have a higher maximum when providers have certain quality indicators, and then a 20% differential when, for example, a provider is 4-star rated. And under Parent Aware, which my colleague Deb will get to in a little bit. And so we do provide, the rates as they are, do provide more access to the market for providers who meet those quality differential indicators. And so you can see here that, well, all rates are about that 25th percentile, the kind of shortest bar in the graph. There are providers' rates who are more fully covered, so up closer to the, 60th percentile in some cases, when they have those quality designations. So another way of thinking about that is if a provider meets those and a family attends, their out-of-pocket expenses would be less.
Ms. Posehn, can you say just briefly what the difference is between we're gonna hear about Parent Aware, but like 15% differential means?
Yes, Chair Pinto and members. Yes, the 15 percentile is a Parent Aware rate, 3-star rated program, and providers who hold accreditations and some family child care provider education credentials. And there's a whole list of those. There's quite a few. But like a CDA, a child development associate, would be a common, or a degree in early childhood would be a common way that a family child care provider could get the 15% differential. And then some accrediting bodies, many accrediting bodies actually are recognized in our statute, plus the 3-star parent aware. And then the 20th percentile is 4-star parent aware providers.
Thank you very much. And can I, and okay. Actually, can I just, why as I look at this slide, there's a bit of confusion. Why would the 15% differential in some cases be greater than the 20% differential, as I see in the bars on the right? Can you just explain that?
That is a great question. We will have to get back to you.
Okay.
Glad I just asked. In the non-metro center group.
Well, actually, in three of the six of these, in fact.
The center group. The centers.
Yeah. If you could just get back to us on that, that would be great. And please continue.
Yes, I will, because that is a puzzle. Okay, thank you. Okay, slide 15. All right. So just to recap, because Child Care Assistance Program is also a mechanism recognized to impact racial and economic inequities. In fact, in the recent racial justice report, the Child Care Assistance Program is recognized as a strategy to reduce inequity. And by providing access to childcare, families, of course, can go to work and have access to quality care. And again, it helps providers get what they need to better serve families. And so just for a snapshot in state fiscal year 2020, you'll see kind of the breakout of race and ethnicity of children served by CCAP. So I believe that is my last slide.
Thank you so much, Ms. Pacine, and my apologies to you and the members for the many interruptions. Hopefully there are some helpful clarifications. Representative Bolden, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that presentation, Ms. Pacine. My question is around the survey of rates that is done every 3 years, I think you said. I'm wondering if you could speak at all to the trend that you're seeing with that. I'm wondering how much, like the percentage of change in those rates over time. Is that pretty steady increase? Does it stay relatively the same, or is there a big spike in increase? Can you speak at all to that?
Ms. Pacine.
Representative Chair Pinto, I can definitely get that data. I will say when we look at changes over time, I think it's between 2-3% per change in survey. But now that we've just recently gone to the every 3 years, we only used to do it every two. We used to do it every 2 years. So I guess we do have data on that. I think the best thing for us to do is send that to you.
Yeah, please do. And Representative Bolden, looks like no follow-up. Looks like, okay. Representative Pryor. Get you unmuted.
Yes,
there we are.
You go. Yes, you can count on me. I will have questions. but first of all, I do have to say, Ms. Blazine, it's great to see you again here today. I know you're a familiar face to the committee, but you know, I just really appreciate how careful you are about answering our questions to make sure that we have the clarity that we need. So thank you for being here again. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see you before the end of the session. So I do have two questions, if that's all right, Mr. Chair. The first one is, and maybe if I understood it correctly, it seems that there's more centers, child care centers, that are registered to accept CCAP payments than there are, and maybe I misunderstood it, than there are home-based child care, family-based child care. And I guess, first of all, was I correct in that, in hearing and thinking that?
Ms. Posine.
Chair Pinto and Representative Pryor and members. There are actually, well, number-wise, there are actually fewer centers. I think it was about 1,700 when you added up the certified centers and licensed centers compared to about 2,000 family child care. However, the numbers of children served, which I didn't provide a slide for, but are more dominant in the center category. And I actually have that. Let's see.
Maybe that's something too you can
send
to us.
Yes, there are more children proportionately in childcare centers because of the licensed capacity, and so we can definitely send you the actual breakout of like proportion of children across the board.
And Representative Pryor, if I could just, it seems like the proportion of centers that are registered receive CCAP compared to the number that are not, proportionally, it's a much higher proportion of centers doing it. 85%, I think, was said, as opposed to like 20% of the family child care. But Representative Pryor.
Right. And I guess that was the number that I was thinking of, is the proportion that are registered. And so, so I guess to verify that. And then, maybe then it's up to us as a committee to say, is that, you know, what's behind that? That homes are not signing up for doing this, but centers are. And is that about, you know, barriers for signing up, or is it because of the low rates that are offered? I guess that's maybe a bigger question.
Ms. Posine, any thoughts on the answer to that as to why it's a much smaller proportion of our family child care providers who are signed up as opposed to our child care centers?
Chair Pinto and members, we do a survey of the barriers related to CCAP. I'd have to get that data to see what the differences were between types of providers, which I'm glad to do. But I do know that, for instance, given the amount of paperwork and the billing lag, for instance, they are paid after the fact, so up to 21 days is allowed by law. So I know the lag in payment and the additional work to be part of CCAP is a barrier that might be more less of a driver in centers because they might be more able to handle that. Mm-hmm. So I believe that's a factor, along with if a family child care provider stays full in their area, again, they have less incentive, and just, you know, with slots and centers, there might be just more capacity to take that on.
Mm-hmm. Is there a prior follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess if I understand, we're going to hear about family, friend, and neighbor care, and maybe then that, because I was also wondering about the number of homes that are receiving CCAP payments that are registered through family, friend, and neighbor, but maybe that's another presentation. And then I do have another question on a different area, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Pryor.
And then to go back and just make sure again that I understood, but I think you were talking about families moving that were on the basic waiting list for these payments, and how we have now an infusion of additional funds to move families off of the waiting list into receiving these assistant payments. And you also said that 82% of the families are workers in the critical sector of our economy. So, you know, as a committee, we've talked about how these families that we're helping are actually our essential workers and really are critical to kind of the people that have to be out there on the jobs during the pandemic and getting them the assistance that they need for their families so that their families stay safe and healthy and they're nurtured. That 82%, if I heard that correctly, is that also the families that are in CCAP right now are about 82% working in the critical sectors? Or is this something unique to, or something more about our basics, the people that are on the waiting list?
Ms. Posine.
Correct, Chair Pinto and Representative Pryor members. We The 82% was based on some estimated data that we got from DEED. That was really about families now being served by CCAP. So the expectation is just that the waiting list would mirror that because we don't have that level of detail for the waiting list.
Mm-hmm. And one last follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I mean, you said that just now in the last two weeks, we've been able to get these extra funds and we're starting to move families off the waiting list. I would hope that maybe that at a later date in this committee, we could hear about how that's working because, you know, this is like every week, every month that goes by, if you're a one-year-old child looking, trying to get that nurturing childcare situation, all of this matters. So I'm hoping that we can actually hear more data at a later date about how quickly we are able to move these families off the waiting list.
Thank you, Representative Pryor, and we'll look to either have that during a hearing or at the very least to make sure we get that information sent out to committee members, and I'll ask staff and who are watching here to keep track of that to make sure we get that information to share, but thank you. I don't see other questions, and so I will thank Ms. Posine for a really helpful foundational presentation, and Ms. Sommerfeld, too, for her work in helping to put it together, I know. And thank you so much. We'll move to Ms. Swenson-Clad, and if you can identify yourself for the record and then proceed with your presentation.
Hello, greetings, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Deb Swenson-Clad. I'm the manager of Child Development Services at DHS. We are a sister unit to the Child Care Assistance Program, and delighted to be here today to speak to you about the child care grant programs that we oversee in Child Development Services. And thanks, Jennifer, for putting up the slides, and I will cue you through if needed to move from one to the next. The child development grants that I'll be describing today span five different state general fund budget activities that you've invited us to highlight. I will provide a brief overview of each, along with some additional background information about ParentAware, Minnesota's quality rating and improvement system. The child care grant programs provide a range of services available to Minnesota families with children needing child care, as well as to Minnesota's approximately 9,500 licensed or certified child care programs, along with many thousands of professionals who work in these programs. As I move through the overviews, I'll just note the funding amounts for each of the grant programs, and you'll see both the state general fund appropriation and also the federal funding supporting these grant activities. Across these five grant programs listed on this slide, we do use federal block grant funds along with our state funding as match for the block grants and the state funding. And the execution of these programs helps us meet federal requirements. And before I jump into each of these programs, I thought it would be an important moment to note the unique time we're in and that the grantees that we fund through these different grant programs who have been carrying out services through the COVID pandemic have stepped up in tremendous ways, modifying their services and supports to providers and families throughout the pandemic. And we are very gratified at their commitment and creativity and flexibility during this time as they've worked to support providers. And we, of course, are so grateful for Minnesota's child care providers too, and the ways they've adapted and continued to serve children and families during the pandemic. So let's move forward with the description of each of these programs. The first is the Child Care Facility Grants Program. And this grants program funds actually just one grantee in Minnesota, First Children's Finance. Currently, it is a critical piece of our agency's strategy for addressing child care supply. And as I know the committee is well aware, the lack of quality childcare, especially in Greater Minnesota, has a very tangible economic impact for communities in order to attract and retain and employees and support families. So this grant provides critical services to help communities with childcare shortages address those shortages and helps childcare programs start up or expand and better manage their childcare businesses. The State Fiscal Year 20 grant award was just over $738,000, and of this, $163,000 was appropriated from the State General Fund. In State Fiscal Year 20, a few data points about this grantee's services. First Children's Finance provided 10 communities with assistance in developing and beginning to implement plans to address the gaps in those communities. They produced over 500 new childcare spaces in those communities. And along with that work, First Children's Finance provided some 45 programs with technical assistance and business practices, and over 300 individual early childhood educators with business training. This program or grant through First Children's Finance also provides loans. And so in that year, five childcare programs received loans totaling $300,000, also creating some new spaces and preserving others. Next slide, thank you. So moving on to another budget activity in the state budget, but also a significant grant program for Minnesota, our Child Care Resource and Referral System. This system is known in Minnesota and branded in Minnesota as Child Care Aware, and it's a key part of our state's infrastructure that helps families find childcare and support childcare provider quality. The system also plays a key role in stabilizing and supporting the childcare supply. And quality improvement supports provided, we know, are part of that stabilization purpose, and along with the training and professional development offered to the childcare workforce through the Child Care Aware system.
Ms. Swenson, I might ask if you can to go relatively quickly, if you don't mind, through these grant programs. We can go back to them with questions. I do want to make sure we have plenty of time to talk about Parent Aware and the issue of quality.
Okay.
Thank you.
I will speed through them. I'm just noting that there are 18 local Child Care Aware agencies in the Child Care Aware system, along with one statewide grantee. And to your mention, Chair Pinto, Parent Aware, the Child Care Aware system actually is the key implementing infrastructure for Parent Aware. So I will talk about that in a few more minutes. And I will just, let's move on to that next slide about the next grant program. Child Care Service Development Grants. This is actually yet another program implemented by this key infrastructure of our Child Care Aware system. So Child Care Service Development Grants are known to providers as Child Care Aware regional grants. And these have been longstanding in Minnesota's child care landscape, since 1989. They fund or provide small grants to childcare providers on an annual basis. There's a cycle of grant making that starts in September and rolls out small grants of between $2,000 for family childcare providers up to $3,000 for childcare centers, and provide support for providers, financial support to improve quality, regardless of whether or not they're participating in Parent Aware, to meet basic health and safety requirements and address emergency needs. And then the next grant program is our migrant childcare program. This is the a unique program or grant in my my business area in that it is a grant that delivers direct services to children, specifically children of migrant workers. And it's often paired with Head Start migrant childcare in its service delivery. Our grantee is the Tri-Valley Opportunity Council, and it is funded with both a small state appropriation, but also funding from the Social Services Black Grant, or Title 20. So in fiscal year 20, 778 children of migrant workers were served in this program. And then finally, two, this opening slide about Parent Aware, this provides the same broad information as the other previous slides, but then there are additional slides to follow to describe Parent Aware in more depth. So the purpose of Parent Aware, stated at the top of the slide, is to help families find childcare and early education and help programs improve their practices and ultimately help prepare children for school and life. We see Parent Aware as both a strategy to help stabilize and improve program quality, but also to contribute to strategies that help reduce the educational achievement gap, which we know is significant in Minnesota between children of color and white children, and between low-income children and children from higher-income families. That gap is caused in part by gaps in educational opportunity, and there's a significant and important role for early childhood programs to support children's early education. And so as we talk a little bit more about Parent Aware and the ways in which we're measuring quality in rated programs and providing opportunities for programs to improve their quality, I hope you'll be able to see the connections between the best practices that we're supporting in Parent Aware rated programs and children's growth and development. One of the important components of Parent Aware is its linkages with, as we've already heard this morning, our programs that provide financial assistance to families. So Lori provided some really helpful information about the CCAP program rate differentials for Parent Aware. But importantly, Parent Aware is also linked to the Early Learning Scholarship Program administered by the Department of Education. And indeed, for a family to use a scholarship in that program, the family must choose a program that is participating in Parent Aware. That can mean that they're currently that they're in the process of receiving, of seeking a rating and preparing for a rating, or that they do indeed hold a rating in Parent Aware. And because of these linkages, it's really critical that we have a supply of available star-rated programs and participating programs for families accessing scholarships and CCAP to choose from. Moving on to the next slide, I'd like to spend a little time describing how programs earn stars in Parent Aware. Parent Aware is a quality rating and improvement system, and most states across the country have a QRIS. They do vary in their in key characteristics. Some states have requirements for all licensed childcare programs to participate in their rating system. That is not the case in Minnesota. Minnesota's QRIS is voluntary. And I'd say a key marker of Parent Aware and the way we have structured it and made it available to programs is that it provides a flexible framework for those who do choose to participate. The best practices that I mentioned as driving Care and Aware quality measures and supporting Care and Aware quality measures are called our standards and indicators that child care and early education programs strive for in order to support children's development and prepare them for school and for life. And they fall into, as you can see in our house framework, a set of categories with health and well-being standards and indicators being foundational, along with best practices around teaching and relationships, relationships with families, assessment and planning for each child, and practices around professionalism of the those who are working in these settings. While Parent Aware does use a common set of standards, it is not a checklist or a one-size-fits-all approach. Again, we try to provide flexibility because we know that it supports innovation and creativity and continuous quality improvement. And we recognize that different types of programs look different across settings and may want to pursue a different pathway to achieve a rating. So to say a few words about those pathways to achieve a rating, they do vary by the program type. And this might be a nod back to Lori's slide and your comments, Chair Pinto, about the different types of programs, early childhood programs in Minnesota. Parent Aware service does provide ratings to those who volunteer for them for licensed centers and licensed family child care programs, but also for Head Start voluntary pre-K programs and school-based school readiness programs. And so the pathways that I'll just say another word about do vary for those different program types, including for childcare programs that might seek a national accreditation, which is not uncommon, especially among childcare centers. So for licensed childcare programs that do not have that national accreditation in hand, the pathway to receive a Parent Aware rating involves the opportunity to seek support and coaching and a small grant even before they enter into the rating process. And I'll say a few more words about that in another slide. But then once moving into the rating process, that childcare program, whether center or family childcare provider, has an opportunity to aim to achieve either a 1, 2, 3, or 4 star rating. A different pathway for programs that are accredited, again, as licensed providers, childcare providers, or a Head Start program or a school-based program are accelerated or automatic pathways to a rating. And for these programs, the commonality is that they're all meeting standards set by another body outside of Parent Aware. And we have over years regularly reviewed and crosswalked our standards and indicators between that that rating pathway that non-accredited childcare providers are offered versus these other external systems. So those systems again include national accreditation standards, Head Start performance standards, and the standards outlined in law for school-based pre-K programs. Just moving on to the next slide. This slide just says a few words about, and it allows me to say a few words about the coaching, grants, and training available to the childcare providers who do not have that national accreditation and who are seeking a 1, 2, 3, or 4 star rating. A key part of A quality rating and improvement system is the I in the QRIS, the improvement supports. And here in Minnesota, we offer coaching through our Child Care Aware system. So this means an individual who is a quality coach, like Karen Bradley, whose photo is here on the screen, provides direct support and individualized support to the provider as they get ready for a rating and as they go through the rating process. This quality coaching service is highly valued by those who've received it. We get great participant satisfaction rankings for the quality coach services we provide. And that same, those same agencies that employ our quality coaches also have are delivering training to childcare providers across the state. And they have also staff in each local agency called a professional development advisor, who, when a program is entering into the rating process, can work with the, for instance, the childcare director, center director, or an individual family childcare provider to map out their professional development needs and training needs as they relate to Parent Aware and as they relate to licensing requirements as well. And then a final really key and important part of our improvement supports are our parent, are our grants. So for participating programs, we have grants that can support the and provide incentives to participation, including a $1,000 grant available to those who are just preparing for that rating process in the months preceding beginning a full rating, and then from $1,500 to $4,000 grants once a rating is achieved based on the star rating level.
I'd like to get to questions in the next minute or two if we can. Can wrap up. Yeah, thanks.
Okay. I just actually have two more slides to highlight a few data points, including on this slide, the growth in Parent Aware participation by numbers of rated programs. So noting that as of December of 2020, we see over 1,700 center-based programs and over 1,200 family child care programs participating or holding a Parent Aware rating. I'm happy to say more about that if you're interested. And then on the, with respect to the children served in Parent Aware rated programs, as of today, we see over 97,000 Minnesota children attending a Parent Aware rated program. Because one critical purpose of Parent Aware is addressing that achievement gap, we track very closely how many children receiving child care assistance attend a Parent Aware rated program. And some years back established a goal of increasing that percentage over time with the aim of reaching 65% of CCAP children being served in a rated program. And we've actually exceeded that goal today. 68% of children receiving child care assistance ages 0 to 5 attend a Parent Aware rated program. So with that, Chair Pinto, I'm happy to take questions.
And thank you so much, Ms. Wiesenklatt. Thank you for putting that together, and thanks for your patience for accommodating us. We were just want to be sure, just in case there were a number of questions, there may not be too many. I'll ask members, please raise hands. And as you do, I'll just ask a couple things while waiting for anybody else to have questions. Can you talk about the reason that there are, again, there's a relatively small proportion of our family child care providers participating? Do you have data or information as to that? And then Representative Pryor, I'll call on you after that. Ms. Wiesenklatt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. I think that some of Lori's comments about family child care participation in CCAP are relevant to Parent Aware as well, in that, of course, both programs do require effort on the part of the provider, and for family child care providers, they're in a unique role in comparison to child care centers, being individuals on their own, working long days, providing direct care individually or maybe with another staff person or two, but without some of the infrastructure that a child care center can perhaps provide in terms of handling the paperwork documentation needed for a Parent Aware rating. That said, or importantly, the Family Child Care Task Force, which I know some members of the committee have served on and has just wrapped up its work, had as a duty to examine barriers to family child care provider participation, and came up with, identified some really wonderful recommendations, a number of which are administrative in nature, have certainly been ones that we've been pursuing, but have provided, I think, some new and really helpful direction for DHS, but also our grantees and partners to pursue to remove barriers.
That's helpful. Thank you. And I guess I'll certainly invite Representative Wasilik, the co-chair of the task force, Representative Damuth, who's on it, if you have any insights on this right now, or we can save that for when we talk about the Family Child Care Task Force. In the meantime, Representative Pryor.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question is, one question I have is, it sounds like there was, something that worked very well when you talked about the number of children that were part of the CCAP program, families that were receiving this child care assistance, and that they were moving into these high quality programs where people have training, they have coaching, that we know that the nurturing that we need to be there in these programs exists. So, and what were the strategies to accomplish that? I mean, you set the goal, but then there had been some follow through to actually make it happen. So could you talk a little bit about the strategies that led to that success?
Ms. Winston-Clark.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pryor, that's a great question. I think one of the key strategies that comes to mind is ties back to our Child Care Aware system of resource and referral agencies, who are our key implementation partners in supporting Parent Aware. And one role that I did not identify in the slides, but that is an important piece of the Parent Aware implementation, is that we do have at least up to one individual, in some cases full-time, in some cases part-time, in each district of the state who is a recruiter for Parent Aware. So they sit in these local grantee organizations along with the quality coaches and the professional development advisors. And that recruiter position has been supported and driven by strategies to, at different points in Parent Aware's history, reach out intensively to providers serving children receiving CCAP. So we're making that connection on the ground, and providers, of course, who had already been serving CCAP saw, we think, that incentive of the increased reimbursement rate to support their program costs.
Okay. Representative Pryor, looks like no follow-up. Okay. Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Swenson-Clatt, let me start with an apology. I had to step away for a couple of minutes, probably when you covered the material that I'm going to ask about. So can you just review for me, because frankly, we've debated it back and forth over the years enough that sometimes I get confused on where we landed because I've been engaged enough in the debate. what is the connection between the STAR rating system, parent aware rating system, and the early childhood scholarship program?
Great.
Good. Actually, yeah,
my apologies.
Yeah, Ms. Swenson-Klatt. We can maybe bring that slide. I think it's actually very foundational. Let's bring that slide back up, actually, perhaps, if we can. And if that's possible, Ms. Sommerfeld. There we go.
Yes. So Chair Pinto, Representative Dabney, thank you for that question. Yes. Again, early learning scholarships, along with the Child Care Assistance Program, are two primary mechanisms for families, supporting families in accessing early childhood and child care when they have low incomes. And different, though slightly different from child care assistance, for early learning scholarships, a family with a child receiving a scholarship must select a parent-aware participating or rated program. There's been indeed some back and forth in over time in statute about the point in time that the specific requirements for a parent aware rating tied to scholarships might change. So at this moment in time, Minnesota statute was modified to say that as of now, a program that is participating in parent aware, getting ready for a rating, or holding a 1, 2, 3, or 4 star rating are the types of programs available to parents with scholarships. As of, I believe, July 1, 2024, there will be a change in statute that would require that only 3 and 4 star or 4 star rated programs would be available to parents holding a scholarship. So that that date has moved back and forth a couple of times in statute as the legislature and our stakeholders have, I think, navigated the realities of the supply of rated programs, not wanting to limit too early that supply in the process of growing the scholarship program and parent aware.
Thank you for cleaning out some of the cobwebs in my brain. I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, thank you, Chair Dabney. And let's see here. I just wanted to verify then, Ms. Swenson-Klatt, for myself, maybe for others as well, that states throughout the country have these quality rating and improvement systems. Our version of it is parent aware. We, of course, want enriching experiences for kids, for children, and the way of measuring that quality in our state is this program called Parent Aware, as you've described. First of all, am I kind of saying that correctly?
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe so, yes.
Okay, and you pointed out that there are other ways that other states do it. As you say, in some states it's mandatory, but other ways of having a QRIS, this happens to be the one that we've been using, but is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. I know I noted that one type of variation in quality rating systems across the country is the voluntary or mandatory nature of it. I think I mentioned there are states that require, that really build their quality rating and improvement system into licensing. So one is, by virtue of becoming licensed one in some states, you are, for example, holding a 1-star rating with then the opportunity to move up voluntarily. Other states, including our neighboring state, Wisconsin, for example, have an approach that is mandatory for CCAP participating programs. So another design. And then there's wide variation in approaches to the number of star rating levels, the standards and indicators that a state chooses to move forward with, driven by the particular needs and circumstances and kind of missions and visions of each state. But I think there's generally so Minnesota's four-star level rating system that's available for our childcare providers is one that probably is kind of middle of the road in terms of the number of rating levels. We have really strived for a balance of simplicity along with a robust tie to the best practices that support children's development.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not seeing other questions. I'll maybe just note, I'm sorry, you know what? A correction, Representative Wasilewicz, swinging on in. We'll call on you. We'll have you be the last one, Representative Wasilewicz.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Not a question, just to your point and Deb's point earlier about the parent aware sort of recommendations. There is a whole host of recommendations in the most recent Family Child Care Task Force report, and one of those is about streamlining paperwork, but there are several other suggestions in there for how to make this work better for family child care providers. So encourage folks to take a look at that. We'll be discussing the report at some point, but encourage folks to take a look at that if they have questions about what we're looking at doing with the Parent Aware program.
Thank you very much, Representative Wasilewicz. And I guess I'll just try to tie in our last couple of weeks with this quality conversation, just to point out that we now have seen in our presentations how important it is that that children have enriching experiences, these nurturing relationships, et cetera. So the quality really does matter, right? That it's not just the child is someplace and then returns home physically safe, but there actually be an enriching experience there. We have such amazing childcare providers doing that work. I guess I'm just thinking about what we heard on Tuesday, with the incredibly low pay, the lowest wages of any occupation required a high school diploma. And the one that really jumped out at me was that a quarter of childcare providers are concerned about feeding their own family. And it seems to me like it'd be pretty hard to provide a high quality experience for a child, however it's measured, if you have those concerns. This is really helpful to understand how things are working. And thank you so much, Ms. Swenson-Clatt, for your presentation. And to Ms. Pocine for yours, and again to Ms. Sommerfeld from DHS putting this all together. So members, we're still pulling together a few details for next week, so look for your email and members of the public as well regarding the details of those hearings. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend, and we are adjourned. Thank you.